Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to take a look at the world of insects today with PJ Leash back once again. He manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him talk about, among other things, how Wisconsin became the dairy state and the role an insect played in that designation. We'll also take a look at the state's pollinator insects. This is Pollinator Week in Wisconsin. He'll take your bug-related questions as well, so I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And I hope you'll go to the page, the Ideas Network Facebook page, even if you're not going to post something, because we do have an insect, a photo of the insect that changed Wisconsin, maybe, or helped change it, into a dairy state. PJ Leash, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here, Larry.
So tell us about this insect.
So there is a tiny insect, and it's still around today. It's called the chinch bug. And most folks, if you saw it, you probably wouldn't pay much attention to it. They're really small. They're just over an eighth of an inch long, tiny black and white things. And we don't see them that often. They do much better under dry conditions. So if you think back a year like 2012, we had that pretty bad drought that summer. Yep. We had quite a bit of chinch bug activity that particular summer. But otherwise, in a rainy year, you don't see much of them. But the general story with this is back in the 1800s, the early days of statehood, Wisconsin was actually a top wheat producer in the country, or one of them. And a lot of things were going on. We had falling wheat prices and volatility in the markets and overworked soil and some other factors going on. And it was right about the time that the dairy industry was starting to be up and coming in the state.
Pick up a bit, yeah.
Yeah, but during that point in Wisconsin and really the country's history, there were some really dry periods in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. And those dry conditions helped this chinch bug and some other interesting insect stories, too. And so we had just bumper crops of the chinch bugs for several years in a row, and it kept decimating the wheat crop again and again and again. And the poor farmers at the time, they didn't have any real ways to manage it. And eventually they said, and scientists figured out this thing really likes to feed on grasses, so wheat and corn and grasses and related plants. It didn't feed on things like alfalfa. And that's right at the time the dairy industry is getting going. And so the farmers said, you know, let's try some of these other crops. We can feed it to livestock. And so this little tiny insect played a role in kind of shifting agriculture in the state from growing a lot of wheat to being the dairy state.
We don't have a photo, I don't think, of the chinch bug up, but I tell you what, it's amazing what a little insect can, the role it can play in something pretty big.
Yeah, and it's really because they were just ungodly abundant those years. I mean, they were so small, but you had millions and billions of them that they took out the wheat crop again and again.
Well, this is Pollinator Week in Wisconsin. How do you define a pollinator?
I mean, a pollinator is really any creature that's going to a flower and doing some pollination along the way. And some insects we know, like bees, are really good at that. They have adaptations, special hairs to collect the pollen and move it around. So they're really good examples of pollinators. But over time, folks are starting to realize there's a lot of other insects that are pollinators, and some of them can be really good pollinators too. There are flies, for an example, and some of these flies can be the same ones that go to things like roadkill to lay their eggs. And the maggots might develop on roadkill, but the adult flies go to flowers and can do some pollination. There's also moths and butterflies that can be pollinators. There are some beetles that can be pollinators. Even some of our wasps, like yellow jackets, that will show up at the picnic pop cans. If they're going to a flower for nectar, they have quite a few hairs or seedy on their
trunk.
They're going to pick up some pollen and move it around too. So really any insect that's going to a flower can do a little bit of pollination, and some are just better than others.
Good thing, given the fact that we've had so many problems with our honeybees.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of pollinators are facing declines at the moment, and it's really for a variety of reasons. habitat loss and land use changes, and habitat is just getting fragmented, and it's a fraction of what they used to have. We don't have as many flowering plants around, and some of these perhaps are what we'd consider weeds, but if they're in agricultural fields or home lawns, we don't like them there, and we get rid of those, we're getting rid of a potential food source for pollinators. There's diseases and parasites like mites that can affect some pollinators. A lot of other things going on, too.
Well, we have some callers on the line. By the way, you can join in. There's a number for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Valerie in Appleton, talking about bees, for example, she has something relating to bees. Hi, Valerie.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just moved here to Wisconsin last year. The house I'm renting, right at my sliding glass door that I use a lot, and I have a little 2-year-old here, I'm also allergic to bees, has a bumblebee nest right underneath the door there. So every single time I go to open the door and close it, they're buzzing up and they'll kind of dive bomb me to get away. I know they're not vicious, but being allergic to bees, it makes me very nervous, and they also keep getting in the house. Last year, I tried spraying peppermint oil to encourage them to leave. That didn't work. This year, I've tried spraying peppermint and cinnamon oil to encourage them to leave. That didn't work. How can I get them to find a more hospitable place?
Yeah, and unfortunately, there's not really going to be a way to get them to simply move. And the story with bumblebees is early in the year.
Are you sure they're bumblebees first? Are they really bumblebees, or are they something else? Because they're coming out of the ground?
No, they're not coming out of the ground. There's like about an inch space between a concrete step and where the house is, and then it looks like there's a little thing of wood siding, and it looks like they're going in that space and maybe behind the wood siding.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we do have some of our bumblebees that can nest on occasion in what they're really looking for is a hollow void. In a lot of cases, bumblebees will go to an old rodent burrow, a hollow void or cavity under tree roots or in a planter box or something like that. On occasion, if there is a gap in a foundation, they can get into a wall void. They might set up a nest there. But unfortunately, there's not really a way to encourage them to move on. Once they kind of set up shop, that's where they want to be for the year. About the only time you might feasibly be able to move them is if they were in some type of man-made object. And what I mean by that is occasionally bumblebees will start building a nest in an object like a old bird box. And if they're in there and you can seal up the entrance and move that at night when they're less active, that may be one way to move it. But once they're in a location like a wall void, we just can't get to them to remove the nest. And also, if you try disturbing that nest, just the act of disturbing it might be stressful enough and cause enough damage to the colony that they may not make it on anyway. So unfortunately, there's not really good ways to move bumblebees in your type of situation.
So what would be then she's probably got to eliminate them because, it's a danger. She's allergic.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a case like this, that might be one consideration to make. The other thing, you know, if you have other doors on the house that you could use, but then that means you're going out of other doors the rest of the summer pretty much until the colony dies off in the fall. So unfortunately, it might be one of those situations where, especially with the known sting allergies, you might have to do something to take out that nest.
And once the nest is taken out, you then probably should get in there with some caulk or something, I would guess.
Exactly, Larry. Yeah. If we have these pre-existing cavities around, there's a chance that in future years another bumblebee might stumble upon it and find a good spot.
So sounds like that's the case because it's 2 years in a row, she said.
Yeah, yes. And the colonies die out in the year, so it's not the same group. It's a different queen comes in and starts a new colony from scratch. But that's an important point you made, Larry. If during the fall or winter months or early spring, look for entrance points like that or other hollow voids in your yard, old gopher burrow or chipmunk burrow, something like that. Yeah. If we can plug those up, that's going to eliminate potential nesting sites for them.
Valerie, does that help you out?
Yes. I was trying to be kind to them, but it sounds like I was actually going to ask the landlord if there was like no way to encourage them to move to get some of that like expanding foam and fill that whole thing and below between the step and the door, and maybe that'll
Yeah, you don't want to do it, though.
I hate to trap them in there, but...
You don't want to trap them in there, for sure.
Okay.
Because if it happened to... They get pretty mean, pretty angry, and if there was... Isn't it true that if they got to the wood... I mean, if it goes all the way back to the wall, couldn't they even burrow through that?
Well, I mean, in general, if we seal them up on the outside, they're going to be desperately looking for a way out. And that may force them to crawl through pipe chases and things like that in a wall void and come out in weird locations. So we don't want to seal it up first. In a case like this, what you might have to do is have someone treat with an insecticide dust, unfortunately. And I know bumblebees are in decline, so it's one of those unfortunate cases where this is kind of a route you might have to go. But we would treat with insecticide, a dust-type formulation. Once a colony is eliminated, then seal things up. If they're still live and they're trapped in there, they're going to be trying to get out somehow.
And if you do it yourself, probably do it at night?
Yes.
While they're resting. There you go, Valerie. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah, here we're talking about trying to save them. But there are times, I guess, especially in a situation where you have an allergy and then a two-year-old who may also be allergic.
Yeah. Yeah, this is an unfortunate situation when you bump into these. I mean, there are quite a few other cases where folks will contact me. They have bumblebee nest in their yard, and it might be... you know, under a flower pot in the back corner of their yard. Yeah. And if they can just leave it alone. Or steer clear, put a cone near it so the kids stay away the rest of the year, then just let them run their course and they'll disappear on their own come fall.
Thanks very much for calling. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your insect question. Tom and Hazel Green emailed to say that recently he's noticed a quote-unquote new insect. He's never seen it before anyway. To him, it looks like the infamous kissing bug that carries the Chagas, is it, mm-hmm. disease? He lives on Wisconsin's southern border. Is this bug possibly here, or could he be confusing what he is seeing with some other bug?
Yeah, so I would suspect it's probably some other bug. And the best way for me to tell for sure, if you can send me some pictures by email, I can usually tell pretty easily. There is a critter out there called a kissing bug associated with a disease Larry mentioned called Chagas disease, which is, it's not a good disease to get, very hard to treat. And that insect does occur, and there's a number of species, but really more to the south of us. They have never been found in Wisconsin ever. We do have quite a few folks that will email me throughout the year thinking they found them. The top lookalike I see is a creature called the western conifer seed bug. And this one feeds on seed cones, on pines and spruces and things like that. They're really common. They do like to sneak indoors, especially in the fall. They're about 3/4 inch long, kind of brownish. Two things help identify those. In the middle of the back, there's a white zigzag pattern. It looks like a lightning bolt or an upside-down number 4. That's one key thing to look for. Also, the hind legs, it looks like they're wearing bell-bottom pants from the 70s. They have this really wide flare on the legs. So if you see that, it's a western conifer seed bug. There are a number of other lookalikes, sometimes from the same family as kissing bugs, the assassin bug family. But we've got a lot of native species here that are really pretty harmless to people. But again, if you can send me some pictures by email, I'd be able to tell you exactly what it is.
PJ Leash, our guest today, who directs the insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison, our guest on the Ideas Network. If you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, or maybe an experience to share. Love to hear from you. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, engineering today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking insects today with our guest, PJ Leash of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. John in West Allis emailed to say he's wondering what's going on with the tick population this year.
Well, the reports I've had thus far suggest we're having a pretty good tick year. And it's not all that surprising. The last few years have been really pretty good tick years. And we're at the time of the year where we're seeing a lot of tick activity, especially from adult wood ticks and deer ticks. As we get into the summer months, then we're starting to see more of some of the juvenile stages, especially for things like the deer tick. But at the moment, I've had a lot of different tick reports coming in. Again, it tends to be wood and deer ticks. I would mention, actually, some of my colleagues in the department have come up with a tick app, which you can get for your smartphone. And basically, it's for a big research study, both here and in a number of states. And they're gathering just some basic information and ask you a series of questions in the app. It's called the Tick App. And they want to know, did you do things like gardening? Did you hike? Did you walk the dogs? Are you camping? Things like that. And then, did you find any ticks today? And what type of precautions you use? And so they're going to gather all that information and see what type of trends they can pick out from the data. So that's an interesting new app that's come out.
Citizen Science Project, again, we've got going there. And just go to the App Store and...
Yep. It was pretty easy to download. I've got it on my phone, and I've been logging tick apps. It'll send you a reminder in the evening and ask you, did you find any ticks today?
All right. We have Rita wondering how important the wasp population is in Wisconsin. She has a bee house in her backyard. She hasn't seen bees there, but she's seen these little wasps, not the type that sting people, she says. Is their presence good for pollination, or do you discourage them, or what?
Well, I wouldn't try to discourage those. In general, they're probably not doing a whole lot of pollination. When it comes to wasps, though, we have thousands of different species in the state. I mean, folks recognize the yellow jackets and paper wasps, the big stinging ones. There's a lot of these very small solitary wasps that really aren't going to sting you, even if you get close. They tend to be really pretty docile. Some of them have behavior somewhat similar to our cavity nesting bees, where they like to nest in small hollow tubes, but instead of gathering nectar and pollen to feed their young, they are going after insect prey. So they can actually be doing a little bit of pest control in your yard. Some of the species that fall into the solitary wasp group go after things like grasshoppers and tree crickets and related creatures. There are some that go after caterpillars. There are some that can actually specifically collect spiders. And that's what they feed to their young, some of these solitary wasps. So if anything, they're doing a little bit of pest control for you. They're really pretty harmless. I have noticed in my own yard, if you have a prune bush like a rose bush, they like to tunnel in the little pithy center in the prune thing. And they don't really cause any harm to the plant, but they nest in there and they just kind of go about their business.
Interesting. Corbett in Birchwood has something for us. Hi, Corbett.
Hello, and thank you for the program.
Sure.
My question is, about 3 weeks ago, woke up in the morning and there were what I thought were hundreds of these. They were black, about 5/8 of an inch long. They were definitely not ants. A small head, black wings, all black, three legs on each side, and they weren't like walking. They were kind of like almost swimming. And really weak, like just sweeping them killed them. And then there were thousands, if not 10,000 of them, just everywhere. And I've been here for a number of years, never seen anything like it. So I swept them, and then I got on the riding mower and gave them the Ginsu treatment. And they weren't flying, but I was just wondering what they were.
Hmm. So this was outdoors?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, easily an acre, and on every blade of grass, three or four of them. But they weren't flying.
Are you near the water at Birchwood?
Yes, right on the water.
Okay. I mean, that's an important clue, I think. We do have a lot of insects that will come out of water, various small caddisflies. There's also a creature called an alder fly, although those are closer to about an inch long. And these insects basically emerge in mass from bodies of water. And as adults, they might not live that long. So they tend to kind of land on plants and move pretty lethargically. So without seeing a picture, I can't tell you a whole lot, but I would just be suspicious from the description. It might have been one of these aquatic insects, but there could be some other possibilities out there as well.
So if you can send a photo of one to you, PJ, you can...
Yeah, if you ever want to send a photo or a sample to me, anyone listening, if you go to the website for the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, if you just Google search that, you'll be able to find my lab. I've got all my instructions on the website for how to get an email contact with me and also how to send in physical specimens as well.
All right. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Corbett. Appreciate it. Chad in Hayward, your turn.
Yeah. Hey, another tick question. I am new to the great state of Wisconsin, moving here from Indiana, and have heard more about ticks since living here than I've heard in my entire life, I think. And so I'm wondering if you can give a tick primer as far as good tick, bad tick, and is there a way to treat those where you can get rid of them? And also, is there something else to be aware of other than a tick? It seems like everybody has the tick on the most wanted list, but is there another bug that's kind of a Wisconsin thing to be aware of?
Sure. Well, I guess other things to watch out for, we've got 60 or so species of mosquitoes, but those are pretty obvious when they're biting you. But we do have some really major concerns with ticks. At the moment, for deer ticks, for example, it's about 40 or so percent of the adults are carrying the microorganism responsible for Lyme disease. So that's almost a coin flip. And so we do have major concerns with that. Ticks like deer ticks and wood ticks can be found basically statewide these days. And it's an interesting story because we didn't find our first deer tick in Wisconsin until the late 1960s. So to go from kind of zero to 60, so to speak, in about 50 years, that's really an emerging kind of health threat to Wisconsinites. In terms of precautions you can take, a lot of the precautions are actually somewhat similar to dealing with mosquitoes. It's things like long sleeves, using repellents like DEET, Picaridin, and there are a couple other EPA-approved ones, so using those when you're going outdoors. If you know you're going to an area that's got ticks, you know, a certain park where you walk your dog or something like that, in the long run, it might just be best to try and find another location so you can avoid those outright. Otherwise, if you are a hunter or outdoorsman, you spend a lot of time outdoors and you know there's ticks around, you can get some clothing treatments that contain permethrin. You can treat your clothes, and that lasts usually through several washings, and that's some long-term protection for your clothing. And then, of course, if you have any pets, chat with your veterinarian, get them on an appropriate flea or tick prevention. And also, when you're done for the day and you come in, make sure to do tick checks on yourself, kids, any pets you have as well.
And there's some clothing that's actually sold with the permethrin already built into it.
There is, yeah. And that stuff's neat. Originally, the technology came about through the U.S. military to have this long-term protection, not have to carry jugs of repellent with you everywhere you went. And those types of clothing, the repellency can last through washing after washing. So we're talking you can have long-term protection from those types of clothing.
And in your own home situation, your lawn and so forth, is there anything? I mean, Chad, you're not going to get rid of ticks, but what could can you make it better around your own home?
Yes, that's a great question. There are some things you can do, and as you alluded to, you're probably never going to be able to eliminate them entirely unless your yard were, say, a sandbox. Ticks in general don't like dry, sunny, open areas because they have to basically regulate their moisture in their body. If they get too dry, they can die from that. So they're often associated with plants. We don't find them as often in home lawn settings because it's bright, open, relatively sunny. Where we tend to find them is along the edges of yards where you have a lot of vegetation, so where the woods butts up against the lawn. So sometimes what homeowners can do, or you can have a pest control company do this, they will treat a barrier, maybe about 10 feet or so, right where the edge of the yard meets a wood lot or something like that. The thought is if there's ticks out in the woods and they're trying to migrate in, we kill them there before they get into the rest of the lawn. So you don't necessarily have to go out and treat your entire lawn. If you have kids, for example, maybe it's better to locate the swing set closer to the house in the middle of a lawn versus closer to the edge with the woods. So there are some things that you can do to help reduce the risk of ticks in your yard.
Chad, does that help out?
Hey, that's super helpful. I feel knowledgeable now.
All right. Appreciate the call. We will turn to Linda in Beaver or Beaver Dam. Is it Beaver or Beaver Dam?
Linda? Beaver. Hi.
Hi. Thanks
for taking my call, and it's Beaver.
Okay.
First, I have a comment. We bought property along the river a couple of years back, and I stopped my husband from cutting down some milkweeds, and I actually transplanted him into a certain area. And this is the first year I've actually seen the monarch caterpillars eating on the leaves. So I'm really happy about that.
Good for you.
Next, I have a question. I have peonies growing in an area, and they are loaded. I mean, every bloom is loaded with, it's almost like a potato bug, brownish, a light green beetle-like. And, I mean, they're just all over it, like an orgy almost. There are just tons of them. And now they're transferring to my blueberry bushes. I've cut a few of it down and put it in the fire pit and sprayed them down. And I don't know what to do. They just keep coming right to the peonies, it seems.
And Linda, you said you mentioned they do look kind of beetle-like in appearance.
Oh, yes. They're a light tannish with a hint of green.
Okay, so mostly tan or more green on the body?
More tan.
Okay. What I wonder then, and I had two top suspects in my mind, this time of the year, especially in parts of the state with sandy soil, we have a creature that's very active called the rose chafer. And it's basically like our native version of the Japanese beetle, if you know what that is. It's active in June and into early July before it's done for the year. And they feed on a wide range of plants. And the adult beetles are about maybe a third of an inch long. And they are a distinct kind of beige color to the body. And they feed on a wide range of plants out there. They tend to nibble around the tougher veins, sometimes skeletonizing the leaves. What you could do if the plants are in flower, we perhaps want to try avoid spraying things just because any pollinators that go to the flowers could get impacted. But if it's possible to go out and just knock them into a bucket of soapy water, that's one great non-chemical way to go about dealing with them. Otherwise, some folks will occasionally use fine mesh netting to physically keep the insects off the plants, or you could try even spraying them with soapy water, and that might help control them as well.
Yeah, I'm betting rose chafers.
Yeah.
Sounds like it to me. Good luck, Linda. Thank you for calling. Annie in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Say, I have seen a lot of these little red bugs. They look like spiders, but the body isn't any bigger than a pinhead, and there's multiple legs. They move really fast, and if you squash them, they leave a red mark.
Well, with the description, I've got a couple of suspects. My top one would be a creature called a velvet mite. And these are little, distinctly bright reddish mites. They do tend to scurry around on lawns and back patios and on rocks and things like that. They're actually predators of insects and other small invertebrates, so they're harmless to people, probably helping you out. They might be a little bit of a nuisance if they're crawling around your back deck and things like that, but that would be my top guess, is something called a velvet mite.
Makes sense. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Craig in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Craig.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I've got a sunburst locust in my yard, and every year, late May, early June, the tree just becomes inundated by a beetle, and they're iridescent green, and they will just, I mean, the leaves are just heavy with them, and they're clinging together a lot. They don't fly around a lot. They just all of a sudden show up, and like I said, they're there 1-2 days, and then they just drop off. Some die, but the majority just disappear. It's only on a sunburst locust. So I was wondering what they would be. They're about maybe an inch long, actually a very pretty bug. They're, mm-hmm. like I said, iridescent green, and only a sunburst locust.
Do they have orange legs on the body?
No, I remember them as being a darker leg. I mean, some might be orange, I guess. I don't remember, but the body is, just like a iridescent green. They're actually quite
pretty
attractive bugs, I guess. So a bug can be attractive.
Japanese beetles?
Well, I don't think Japanese beetle with the size. My suspect, there's a creature out there called a blister beetle, and there's a bunch of different species. There's one called Say's blister beetle, which is matches the description. It's about an inch or so long. Shiny green. It is a rather attractive looking beetle. They historically tend to pop up about this time of the year, and I see more cases in the western part of the state. Eau Claire and Pierce County and locations like that have had a few reports recently. Tends to be on plants from the legume family. And what they do, they seem to show up out of the blue. They tend to nibble on the flowers for couple days, and then they seem to disappear without a trace. Huh. And that's the pattern we see these. They usually don't cause too much harm. I had asked about the orange legs because often they have orange legs with that, although there's a couple close related species. But I suspect a type of blister beetle. I would maybe do some Google searches and just look for blister beetle images and see if you find a match. That's what I suspect you have. Just a other note about those, they get the name of blister beetle because they contain a chemical defense that if you were to squish it on your skin, it's going to cause a blistering type wound. So I wouldn't go around squishing them with my bare hands if they are indeed blister beetles. I'd let them run the course and disappear on their own.
They're not going to kill in the tree or anything.
No, I've never really heard of any reports of significant damage. As I mentioned, the pattern, and I see this every year, they show up, they nibble on flowers and maybe leaves for a couple days, maybe, and then they just disappear out of the blue.
But you're
right in that part of the state. I think that's probably it.
So Google blister beetle and see what you see there, Craig. Thank you for calling. Wendy in Cedarburg, your turn. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
We have had some tiny black, I don't know if they're beetle. I'm just going to call them a bug. They're the size of a sesame seed, maybe a little smaller, same shade. Or shape, and they have wings, but I rarely see them fly. They just sit there. I mean, they're easy to sweep up and pick up and vacuum up. Occasionally, I'll see one kind of move on the floor. They're very slow. And we'll sweep them up, we'll vacuum them up. We won't see them for a day or two, and then all of a sudden in the morning, there's like 15 or 20 of them on the bathroom floor again. And now we're finding them on carpeted areas in other rooms. So I don't know what they are, where they're coming from, or how to get rid of them.
Yeah, so definitely a mystery type situation we've got here. I think in this case with the small size, because I can think of a number of possibilities, some small flies, some small beetles and things like that. I think in this case it'd be really helpful if you were to send in a physical sample to me. That way I can get them under the microscope. And when we do that, we'll know exactly what they are. And then that'll tell us, most importantly, where they're coming from and also what we can do about them. Sometimes these insects indoors have a source that might be something in the kitchen pantry and a food item. Sometimes it might be somewhere else. But until we know exactly what it is, we won't know where they might be coming from. So I'd encourage you to look up my lab and send me some physical samples in the mail, and we can go from there.
The UW Insect Diagnostic Lab is the place to go, Wendy. Thank you for calling. Janie in Nakusa, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, wonderful show as usual.
Thank you.
I have these little insects came in the window at work about a week ago, and they were like a long, skinny fly. They aren't a half inch long, but they've got little transparent wings, and I grabbed some of them. I was going to send them in, and then I thought maybe today I might get a quicker answer what they would be.
Sure. And are you near any bodies of water, a lake, pond, stream, anything like that?
Well, there's a river, but we're not close to it.
Okay. I mean, are you even within a mile or two of it?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I would wonder, this time of year, and really around the state, there are a number of aquatic insects that can be strongly attracted to lights at night. And one thing that comes to mind in particular, which are some small flies, there's a group we call the midges. Sometimes folks call them lake flies. And there's a lot of different species. Sometimes they're neon green, sometimes they're blackish, but they're small, slender flies with clear wings. And some of them being small enough, they can fit through window screens and sneak in. And so I wonder if that might be what you're bumping into.
Interesting. Anything, and not much you can do about that either, is there?
Not a whole lot. The best thing to do, if you know that you've got them active in your area, you see them at the porch light at night, try and keep things sealed up. Rather than having the windows open, maybe run the AC if it's warmer, that sort of thing. Otherwise, if you can try and reduce the number of lights that you have on, you might reduce the number you're drawing to a house. Or if you still want to have a light on, maybe you can have the garage light on away from the house and not have as many lights on and kind of pull them in that direction.
All right. There you go, Janie. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's see. We have Melissa on Facebook. She says she has a lot of earwigs and box elders on her milkweed. She's concerned that they may damage the plants. Should she get rid of earwigs and box elders? Box elder bugs, I assume she means.
Yeah. So when I go out and look at milkweed, I do often see earwigs. I don't really expect them to cause much of any damage to the plants, and earwigs are kind of omnivorous scavengers. Sometimes they may feed on some plant material. Other times, though, I've encountered them feeding on insects, too. So overall, I don't really get too worked up about those. Where I tend to see them is they like to hide down in nooks and crannies on the plant where the leaves meet this. And I think they might just be using it as a shelter because I've never actually observed them causing any damage to milkweed plants. And with the toxins that are in milkweed, they probably wouldn't do very well trying to eat it anyway.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, for the box elder bugs, I do wonder if it may be a different creature. And there's a couple of red things that show up on milkweed plants. There's a type of longhorn beetle, but it's got long antennae, very kind of beetle-like in appearance, slender body. That's one possibility. Otherwise, there is a creature called a milkweed seed bug or the large milkweed bug, and those tend to be red and black, and they do resemble box elder bugs in kind of general appearance. They usually don't cause much harm to the plants, though, so it's nothing to really get too concerned about.
There we go. PJ Leash, our guest today, he directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. If you have a question for him or maybe a comment or experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking the world of insects today with our guest, PJ Leash of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for joining us. I want to go back to the caller just before our little break here who mentioned she thought they were box elder bugs, and she did include a photo on our Ideas Network Facebook page, and they are indeed box elder bugs.
Yeah, just took a peek at that during the break, and lo and behold, they are indeed box elder bugs. I wouldn't expect them to feed at all on the milkweed plants. They really feed on developing seeds on box elders and certain other maples and a couple other plants. So that's their food source. I suspect they may just be passing through, so I wouldn't expect any type of damage from those on milkweed.
All right, there we go. Let's take a call from Barry in Mount Horeb next. We lose Barry? Must have lost Barry. Let's go to Jacob in Rolling Ground. Oh, somehow we're having some problems here. So we will instead.
We're two or three different varieties.
Jacob, unfortunately, we missed the first part of your comment, so welcome aboard, and what's on your mind?
Oh, sorry. We had cut down an ash tree recently that had died. The woodpeckers opened up the stump a little bit, and a couple of weeks ago, it was just swarmed with these over-depositor wasps, the ones with the real long over-depositors, and there were two or three different varieties, and about 15 or 16 on there. Everyone who I've told about it, they want to confirmed that they are harmless, and I thought they are, but I thought maybe he could confirm that.
Sure. Yeah, so anytime you have a rotting or decaying tree or declining tree, you get a bunch of insects that start living inside the wood. And then, of course, when you have those insects there, the predators and parasites show up as well. And so there are these really large, somewhat intimidating-looking wasps that can have a body, some species maybe about 2 inches long, and they've got this long ovipositor, which is the technical term for their egg-laying device, or this long filament out the end of their body. And they can actually drill into the wood to find the insect that they want to attack and lay their eggs on. They are indeed harmless. I remember finding one when I was about 10 years old, and it was scary looking at the time because you see this long device, you think it's a stinger, but they're completely harmless to people.
There you go. So no worries there, Jacob. Thanks for calling. Patty in Eden, Wisconsin. Let's go to you. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I want to differ with you about the harmlessness of earwigs. They can devastate a hosta plant, no problem. And they are also bad in a petunia flower bed. They eat every blossom, and they strip all the foliage off of marigolds.
Wow.
Yes. Well, so they do feed on plants. I mentioned they're omnivores. Sometimes they can feed on other insects. Sometimes they will feed on plants. It tends to be, though, plants that are often smaller or closer to the ground. And you mentioned really the top three plants that I hear of actual earwig complaints. It's things like marigolds and hostas. It's these low kind of shrubby plants that hold the moisture in, because earwigs really need damp conditions to survive and thrive in. And so we do get some plant damage on occasion to a couple of plants out there in flower beds and things like that, especially along foundations if you have a rich thick mulch bed that keeps it damp as well. So we do get some plant damage on occasion.
There you go. Thanks, Patty. Appreciate it. Tim in Hammond, Wisconsin. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I have a question for this gentleman. A couple of years ago, I was at a local football game, and the game had just ended. It was dusk, and the field, football field lights had just come on. I was talking to somebody, and I felt something hit my shoulder, and it was enough that I thought somebody had thrown something at me. I looked around, didn't see anybody. Well, and I just kind of sensed something on my shoulder, so I brought my hand up, and I felt something there, and I kind of quickly brushed it away. And then I thought, you know, what was that? And I'm looking around, and here, like 3 or 4 feet away in the ground, I have never seen an insect in Wisconsin this big. It was kind of a flat beetle-looking thing, kind of greenish-brown color. The body itself was probably about 4 inches. And if you took the legs into account, the thing would have been probably 6-7 inches. And little kids saw it, and they were screaming and trying to get a picture of it. And do you know what that would have been?
Yeah, so with the description and actually the location you were at, I'm pretty sure it's a creature called a giant water bug. They also get the nickname of electric light bugs because they're strongly attracted to lights at night, and ironically, they show up fairly frequently at sports stadiums because of the really bright sports lights at night, especially in rural areas. The story with these is they're aquatic insects. They're living in streams and ponds and lakes and things like that, but they can be strong flyers and go some long distances. Mm-hmm. So probably came in when the lights came on. As you mentioned, they are about the biggest insects you find in the state, easily 3 to 4 inches long, and then you got the legs on top of that. They are from a group we call the order Hemiptera. They have these sucking mouth parts, and in this case, they're actually predators, and they're big enough they can feed on vertebrate animals like fish and frogs and even small turtles, which is pretty impressive for an insect to be able to do that. But
they're not going to bite us.
Unlikely, but that's one of the few insects I tend not to pick it with my bare hands, Larry. Because if it does bite you, they've got a little soda straw for a mouth part. They basically inject some enzymes that are going to liquefy their dinner so that they can drink it up. So I know someone that's been bitten. It didn't sound like it was a pleasant experience.
Oh, there you go, Tim. Thanks a lot for calling. Right, but if you leave them alone...
Yeah, probably the only way you'd get bitten is if you picked him up and misheld him. If you even grabbed him by the sides, you'd be fine. But if you held him flat on your palm, there's a chance they could give you a nip.
All right. Tim, thanks. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Barry in Mount Horeb next. Hi, Barry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a question about ground bees. I've tried the humane way of trying to get rid of them, and then I tried some wasp foam, and that didn't work either.
Okay. So when you say ground bees, is this where you have one hole in the ground and a bunch of black and yellow things are coming out?
Yeah, actually, I've got two holes right next to each other, but yeah.
Okay, okay. So those are actually, rather than being bees, it sounds like a case of a ground nesting yellow jacket. We do have ground nesting bees, but they tend to live, each female lives alone, and they're actually surprisingly docile. You can get within inches of them, and they won't mess with you at all. The ground nesting yellow jackets, though, they live together as a colony, and they actually construct that same type of paper mache nest, but it's below ground, and they go to an old rodent burrow and things like that. And they can be defensive. If you run that over with the lawnmower or get close while you're weed whacking, they're going to come out. You're probably going to get stung. Two things can work best for that. And the general story with these, for starters, is they all die out in the fall. They have to start new nests in the spring, and they build up during the summer months. So if you take them out now, there's fewer workers present. If we wait until August, September, there can be thousands there. So I'd encourage you, if you're going to do something about it, do it now rather than waiting for it. A couple things can do. You can do, if you get a type of insecticide that is a duster powder, that is going to work better than an aerosol spray. The reason for that, you put the duster powder in the entrance to the nest. I would do that at night when they're not active, especially if it's a cooler night down in the 60s or 50s and they're kind of lethargic. Do that at night. Then as the insects come and go, the little dust particles get caught in the hairs on their body and they track it into the nest, and it's going to wipe out the colony. Otherwise, I've had some pretty good results with some of the foaming wasp sprays as well. Sometimes it can be a little tricky, though. If the tunnel going down to the nest takes a turn and the foam doesn't get down in there, you might need to do it again. But usually between those two, it usually works pretty well with a single treatment, or sometimes a second or maybe even a third treatment is needed.
All right, there we go. So a little dust. Deborah in Winona, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I have good insects. I have tons of fireflies. They seem to be out early this year and way more than normal. I've seen maybe 100 at a time or more, and it's wondrous. Is this because of something that's going on in the environment, like we've had a lot of rain this year, or is it just a sign of a good environment?
Well, it may be some of both. We know if you're just in an urban area and you don't have as much green space around, you're probably not going to see as many fireflies. But I think the weather is probably an important factor in this story. And in general, the reports I've seen and had come into the lab, it seems to be pretty good firefly years thus far this year, but also the last couple years. And one thing important about fireflies is that the larvae or juvenile stage, they tend to be predators of things like slugs. And slugs do very well under rainy conditions. We've had lots of rain the last couple springs, so we've had good slug conditions. I would suspect have more slugs, which would mean more food for firefly larvae. So I do suspect that the weather probably plays a role in this story.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot, Deb, for calling. Appreciate it. Randy in Sun Prairie, your turn.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about the emerald ash borer. I've got three beautiful ash trees in my yard, and just I'm worried that they're going to go away, and people are advertising that they can treat for them, and I'm just wondering how effective that is, and is it throwing my money away to do this, something like that?
Sure. And have you been treating the ash trees already, or you'd just be starting?
I have not, because I haven't heard of them being in our area yet in Dane County, and so I'm holding off, not wanting to start too soon.
Yeah, well, they're in Sun Prairie.
Yeah.
Oh, they are. Oh, no.
Yeah, they're definitely around. If the trees are in good health this far, I suspect you've just been lucky, but if you haven't started the treatments, now would be the time to do it. We know the treatments can be effective. We get our best results if they're done preventatively or if the tree is just showing early signs of infestation. If your tree has significant canopy dieback, they just don't work very well because we might have kind of missed the boat on that one. In terms of the treatments, it depends on the size of the tree. If they aren't that big, maybe 15-inch diameter at breast height, which is about 4 feet off the ground. If they're that size or smaller, there are some homeowner options that you can pick up at the hardware store. These are liquid drenches. You follow the instructions on the container. You pour it around the base of the trunk of the tree. This has to be done in the spring, though. If you don't do it in the spring, we know from research experience it may not work very well. So the treatments can work if they're done properly and timed properly. Otherwise, another consideration, you mentioned services providing treatment options. That's an option as well. And the arborists have some products that will protect trees for 2 to 3 years at a time, whereas the homeowner options, you have to do that every single spring.
So, but the professionals could do it now, you're saying?
Yes. Yeah, with the professional treatments, we do get more flexibility. And if you think of big cities out there that are injecting thousands of ash trees, they can't do them all in April and May. They spread that out over the course of the season. But the stuff is long-lasting in terms of protecting the tree. And we've seen some data that it works very, very well for 2 to 3 years, possibly even longer under the right conditions.
What are they normally, what's a range of charges for something like that? Do you?
It's probably going to depend on the size of the tree and some other factors. Uh-huh. I often encourage folks, go with a certified arborist, call around, maybe get a couple of different quotes. For a single tree, it might be somewhere in the ballpark of $200 to $300, depending on the size of the tree in a lot of cases. But if you factor in that you're only doing that every other year, perhaps every 3 years, the cost kind of evens out, because to get the homeowner drench product, that can easily be $50-$60 or more sometimes to get a jug of this stuff.
Okay. So there you go, Randy. I wouldn't wait. You're in Sun Prairie. I can tell you right now, there are emerald ash borers in your neighborhood or in your area. So good luck. Thanks for calling. Jean in West Bend, it's your turn. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have, pretty sure they're pavement ants. They've been increasing every year for, 5 years. They have caused damage in the crack between the house and the patio, and now they're in the other cracks in the patio. Other years, I've used boric acid and sugar, and I did that this year again, only took some of them. I think I have two species, because one species does take that bait. I tried cornstarch and cornmeal. That seemed to wipe them out for a while, and they came back in the thousands.
Gene, I tell you what. Hold on. We need to take a quick look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then you'll get an answer from our guest, PJ Leash of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Taking a look at the world of insects today here in Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, PJ Leash. He is director of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. Always great to have PJ come by, and thank you so much for listening. Questions, call in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And just before the break, we had a caller who has had an influx of what she called pavement ants, and she's tried all different kinds of things to sort of get rid of them, a lot of home remedies from the sound of it. But what have you got to say about those pavement ants?
Yeah, so if they are indeed pavement ants typically prefer food and baits that are more rich in proteins and fats and things like that. And if you use the common liquid-based ant baits, which contain boric acid and usually some water and sugar-type materials in there, they often don't go to those baits much, if at all.
Okay.
And so with ants, one of the main things is trying to find the right bait, the one that they really like. So one of the simplest things you could do is just go to the hardware store and either read through the packages, see if sometimes they will say for protein-loving ants or something along those lines. Try one of those, or ant baits aren't all that expensive anyway, so maybe just pick up a couple and make sure you know which is which and put them out and see which one do the ants go to, figure out which one that is, and then start giving them more of that particular bait, and I would expect that to help out.
All right, there we go. Daniel in Harshaw, it's your turn. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Larry. PJ, how you doing?
Good, great. Appreciate the call.
I said something earlier about doing a perimeter line on your property to keep ticks and bugs like out.
Yeah.
What do you put down for that perimeter line? I've heard of carnivals using boric acid, but I don't know if that really works.
Yeah, so we're not really using that. What folks use is one of the general lawn-type insecticides. We want to use a liquid drench so that we can give a good soaking to the turf and leaf material where a lawn meets a wooded area, for example. Look for ingredients, things like permethrin, P-E-R-M-E-T-H-R-I-N. A lot of these similar ingredients end in the letters T-H-R-I-N, so permethrin, bifenthrin, cifluthrin, cyhalothrin, delta. There's a whole bunch of them out there. They all work about the same way against ticks and insects and things like that. So look for one of those products. You should be able to find them easily at the hardware store, garden center. And one consideration, you might even find one with like a hose attachment. That might be a simple way to do it. Otherwise, if you have to do it with a backpack or pump sprayer, we want to go with kind of a larger volume, coarser droplets to get it down in there amongst the leaf litter rather than just a fine mist on the surface of the lawn.
And how many feet out do you go?
You don't need to spray the entire yard. So we want to go with the barrier maybe 8 to 10 feet wide, kind of where the lawn meets the woods.
Okay.
And that can really help prevent them moving into home lawn areas.
There you go, Daniel. Thank you for calling. Lee in Krakow, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, about 3 years ago, we live on 30 acres, and we were overwhelmed with wood ticks. We couldn't go out for 3-4 hours, and we'd have 5, 6, 8 of them on us. So what I tried doing at Permathon, my understanding is it doesn't repel the ticks. It actually kills the ticks. So what I did is I took some 2-inch tree protector tubes and a bag of cotton balls, and I sprayed the cotton balls really heavy, turned them over, sprayed them again, let them dry, and I stuffed those tubes with cotton balls, and I just went around my trail on my golf cart and I stuck them under brush piles and under fallen trees, things like that. I did like 10 or 12 of them, and my thought was that the mice go around and they pick up these wood ticks, and they're going to make their nest. They're going to grab those cotton balls, bring it back to their nest, and as they roll around in their nest, they're going to kill the wood ticks. Last year, I had maybe 6 wood ticks on me all year. This year, I've had 1 wood tick on me. My dog has had 1, my lab has had 1 wood tick on me. And what makes me think it's working is because we had a back corner of our property where I didn't put any tubes. There's no trail to really get to it. And we were in there late last year, and we got a lot of wood ticks on us. So I made up a couple more tubes. I carried them back in there, threw them back in there. And I went back in there twice this year. I've never had a wood tick on me. So I don't know if your guess is heard about doing that, or if he thinks that's it's nothing scientific. It's just something I tried, and it seems to be working for me.
Ah.
Yeah, so I have heard of practices like this, and there are commercial products out there called tick tubes, and it's very similar to what you described. It's some type of cardstock or a plastic tube. Inside are cotton balls that have been treated with permethrin. Now, this probably isn't going to wipe out ticks entirely, but as you had mentioned, the thought is rodents like mice will go grab the cotton balls, use it for nesting material. It's treated with permethrin, so it will kill the ticks if they were attached to the mice. So there is some truth to this. Again, it's probably not going to wipe out the ticks entirely, but if you live in a heavily wooded area and you know you've got a lot of ticks, this is an additional thing that you can do, and it's probably going to help you out. Just a word of caution, though. I mean, some of my colleagues, we've had discussions about this, and when you read the products that contain permethrin, they don't say on there that you can spray cotton balls and stick them in a tube. And so from a legal standpoint, it doesn't say you can do that, but you can purchase ones, these tick tubes that are already made. So those products are out there.
All right. Thanks a lot, Lee. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Lee in Cudahy next. Hi, Lee.
Hi. I don't know. This isn't really a problem, but I walk the dog every day in a neighborhood on sidewalk. There's all sidewalks. And it is a lot of condominiums and homes, and a lot of companies are using weed killer and everything. The air just reeks whenever they spray. And I don't see any worms anymore. And I don't know if anybody's ever noticed this, but we used to have, when it rained like it has been the last week or so, there'd be a ton of worms on the sidewalks, and there's none.
Oh.
Yes, that's an interesting observation. I do wonder a bit with the amount of rain we've had. You know, sometimes if it's too rainy, that could be detrimental to worms if they're down in waterlogged soil. Surprises me you don't see any at all. I mean, just walking around Madison and Middleton where I live, there's a lot of lawns that I know are getting treated for weed control, and you still see plenty of worms around on the sidewalk. So that one's got me scratching my head in terms of why you're not seeing any at all.
Yeah, me too. That's interesting. Interesting idea. It may well be, Lee, that it's just all that rain has drowned them out. There's been a lot of rain.
Yeah,
for sure. Thank you very much for calling, though. Something to think about, for sure. Christine in Boscobel, your turn. Hi, Christine.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
I have a problem. I've had a huge problem the past couple of years with Japanese beetles destroying plants. This year, rose chafers came into my yard, and I've never had them before, and they're eating everything. And so rose chafers came early, and Japanese beetles are due soon.
Yep.
So we didn't want to put down anything to kill the grubs because we didn't want to kill the good stuff, like the worms and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, in general, in the rose chafer, by the way, it's kind of our native version of the Japanese beetle. It has somewhat similar life cycles, although it's out about a month earlier, during the month of June, and usually by early July, rose chafer is tapering off and Japanese beetle is picking up. I did see my first Japanese beetle a day or two ago here in Madison, so it won't be that long before they're out in force. In terms of dealing with them, I typically don't recommend treating for the grubs unless you know you have a lawn problem with them causing damage to the turf grass or you're expecting it to, because if you try and treat the lawn to kill the grubs thinking you won't have adults, it just doesn't work like that. Both of these insects can be strong flyers, and in theory, you could kill every single grub in your lawn and you're still going to have the adults flying in, so it just doesn't quite work like that. In terms of preventing damage, it depends on the particular plants. We're talking trees versus shrubs and that sort of thing. If you have small shrubs, you know, rose bushes and things like that, there are some both conventional and organic sprays that can be used, you know, your typical tree and shrub type sprays. Those often contain these pyrethroid ingredients that end in THRIN, so permethrin, bifenthrin, cyfluthrin, and so on. And they can protect the foliage for about a week or two at a time, but you have to keep applying them again and again during the season. There are some organic options like pyrethrins, which are a natural chrysanthemum extract, but that breaks down very quickly. There's neem oil that can help, but those are two organic sprays that could be used. Otherwise, if you don't have that many plants, diligent hand-picking or knocking them into a bucket of soapy water can be pretty helpful to prevent some of that initial damage. And if you're diligent and do that every day and you don't have that many plants, that might be an option as well that you could consider.
There you go, Christine. Those are the options. Thank you very much for calling. Sandy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just curious. I have this very tiny insect on my Gerbera daisy plant in the house. It's on the stem, which makes me think it might be related to an aphid, but it doesn't look like it. Its body is about a 16th of an inch long. It's like a little triangular mountain shape, his body. And it's whitish, and it's got huge antenna that are very feathery. They're about, each antenna is about as big as the body itself.
Hmm.
Yeah, interesting. I'm scratching my head a little bit on this one just because of the small size, and it'd be hard to see some of the features on there. I see you are from Madison area, Sandy, so if you want, you're welcome to stop by my lab and bring it in. We can take a peek. I mean, for small things on indoor plants, aphids and something called a thrips would be my top suspects, although neither of them really have feathery antennae. There are technically some very tiny parasitic wasps that parasitize aphids in some cases. There are some of those that can have feathery antennae. Otherwise, one other possibility I can think of that is common this time of the year, and we mentioned these on the show earlier, these little flies called midges, and sometimes they can have very bushy, feathery antennae. Some of the species are very small. It's a chance it could be something like that that maybe snuck in from outdoors and just happened to settle down on the plant.
And you're located at the Insect Diagnostic Lab is located where?
If you're familiar with campus, I'm right across from the Babcock Ice Cream Store. It's 1630 Linden Drive, L-I-N-D-E-N. So 1630 Linden Drive, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. And I'm up on the second floor, room 240.
There you go. So stop by, Sandy. Bring along a few, and let's take a look and see what they are. It'd be great. Thank you very much for calling. Dan and Gillett, your turn. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a couple of quick questions about bumblebees. First of all, are bumblebees solitary, or do they live in hives with other bumblebees? And then the other thing I was wondering about with bumblebees, I've noticed in the fall, when it starts to get cold in the mornings, the bumblebees are kind of the last insects that I see just sort of clustered on the flowers of my sedum plants. And, I mean, it can be, you know, down into the upper 30s, you know, on some October, November mornings, the bumblebees are still there kind of clinging to these sedum flowers. And I'm just kind of wondering what they're doing, and I'm assuming they'll die, you know, once it gets cold, but I'm just kind of wondering what they're doing that late in the fall.
So in terms of general bumblebee biology, they are one of our types of social bees. So they do live together as a colony. It's not a big hive the way that honeybee hives are. A big honeybee colony can have thousands and thousands of workers. A bumblebee hive may have 100, 150 members in the colony, for example. So it's kind of these smaller hives compared to honeybees, but they do live as a group. In terms of what's going on, and bumblebees are one of the insects, some of the species can be active pretty late into the year, October, November, so they can be out as kind of some of our last pollinators for the year. I do wonder, in your situation, you mentioned, you know, days where the temperatures might be down into the 30s. A lot of insects, they have this thermal activity threshold, if you want to call it that, roughly about 50 degrees. If it gets down close to 50 or colder, a lot of insects just can't warm themselves up enough to fly around and be active. So I would almost wonder if they had been out foraging and the temperature dropped and they just got too lethargic, they might not have made it back to their nesting site in that situation.
That could well be. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate the call. Kathy in Washington County, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. My question is back on ticks again. I had also bought commercial permethrin-soaked tick tubes and placed them around wood piles in various areas where I thought the mice might get the cotton out of them. And they did not seem to be that effective for me, because that over the course of mostly May and early June, I found 13 different times I found wood ticks or deer ticks crawling on my clothing. So I was wondering, now I have not seen any lately, and I was wondering, does their activity or at least dissipate as far as coming up around humans and stuff more in the summer, or have I just been lucky?
Well, it actually depends on the time of year and the life stage of the tick. So right now, I'm getting a lot of reports of adult wood and deer ticks, but we know as we get into the summer period, we don't see many of the adults, but if you're taking a close look, we can find more of the juvenile stages of that, but those are a lot smaller and harder to notice. So you can find ticks throughout much of the year, especially if you're going out there specifically sampling for them, but it depends again on that life stage.
Oh, there we go. Thanks, Kathy. Appreciate the call. And so we will go to Vicki in Janesville next. Hi, Vicki.
Yes, thank you for taking the call, and
sure.
Thanks for your delightful show.
Thank you.
I have a flowering almond. It's about 4 years old, and it bloomed beautifully this spring. And now the leaves are curling, some are turning brown, and the leaves are dropping. I don't see any insect on it. Do you know of any insect that attacks the flowering almond?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know if I've ever encountered a flowering almond in the state, so I can't think of any specific insects off the top of my head. I'm sure there would be a variety of caterpillars and beetles and plant bugs and things along those lines. However, given the description with the curling leaves, discoloration and things like that, and knowing that we've been having an extremely rainy year, I would wonder if the plant may have some type of fungal or bacterial disease, and there's a wide range of them out there. You'd have to chat with my colleague, Dr. Brian Huddleston at the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, and he'd have to look at a sample and tell you if it's a disease or not. But that would be my suspicion with the symptoms that you described.
There we go. And the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, if you go online, just type in UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, you can get a hold of Brian. There you go. Kenneth emailed to say he has a spider that he'd never seen before, wondering if it could be venomous. It has a long, narrow abdomen, mostly orange in color, yellow and red designs across its body. The biggest one he's seen is about an inch and a half long.
Okay, well, a couple of things come to mind. If it's very slender, there is a group called the long-jawed orb weavers, and they're, you know, almost stick thin, very, very slender, narrow type of spiders, and there's a number of species out there. They can vary in color. Otherwise, if it's somewhat slender but not stick thin, I would wonder about some type of orb weaver spiders.
Yeah.
And those are really common. They're often very, very brightly, conspicuously colored reds and oranges and yellows and things like that. So that would probably be my top suspect at this type, is some type of orb weaver spider.
Let's go to Thelma in Wausau next. Hi, Thelma.
Hi. Hi. I have a question. I was given a bee house late in May, and I don't know much about that aspect, but according to the directions, just put it up. And I'm just wondering, what time of the year should that have gone up?
Well, in general, I tend to be a fan of putting them out fairly early in spring because you will get some bee species that are out and active as soon as plants start blooming. There are some other species active later in the year, but if you have it out earlier, you offer that nesting habitat to a wider range of potential pollinators that might use it.
All right. There we go. And Joy on Facebook wonders if it's usual to see rose chafers chewing on milkweed.
You know, I've heard of that. I've never seen them take out the plants entirely, but I have seen some pictures and heard of them nibbling a little bit on milkweed plants. They seem to feed on, you know, a couple hundred different types of plants, so it's not surprising they might try it out.
And Brett in Eau Claire says he was able to get rid of ground bees by running a water hose in their nests at night.
So I've heard of that, and it is an interesting idea. It would be a non-chemical approach. In theory, it sounds like it would work. If the colony is small, you know, you may get better results. I have seen some videos on YouTube, though, of folks trying that where it's a large nest, and eventually they make their way out, and they're not happy about it.
You can really risk getting yourself stung.
Yeah.
But if you had it small enough...
If it's, especially this time of year, if it's small enough and there might only be, you know, a dozen or two dozen workers present, that's going to increase your chances of it working. Typically, though, I just go out with one of the dust or foam type products.
And we had Pat, we're running out of time here. She has some concerns about Facebook pesticides getting into groundwater. Maybe comment on that.
Yeah, so that we could go into quite a length about that. The short answer is each pesticide has a different personality, so to speak, in terms of how readily they bind to materials in the soil, how readily they leach through water, how water-soluble they are. We do have some concerns with that, various parts of the state, and water gets monitored for that. It is a concern, though, out there, but each pesticide is different in terms of how readily it gets to water.
And you need to really pay attention to the label.
Yes.
If you're going to use a pesticide, really follow the label directions.
Exactly.
Well, PJ, it's always fun. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much. And you'll be back July 18th. We'll do this all over again.
Sounds good, Larry.
PJ Leash, degrees in biology and entomology from the UW-Madison, manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And as I said, he'll be back July 18th, and we'll do it again. Tomorrow at this time, just looking ahead, Jim Ward will be back with us to take your vehicle maintenance questions. That's tomorrow at 11, right here on the Ideas Network. Thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.